I thought she would pity me. She didn't. She called me disloyal, took the robe I'd made, and left me alone with my caverns, my silkworm sprites, and my steadfast foe. Time. Her stone eyes snapped open, and the Heartsaw Weaver took a step toward me. The spring water stopped coming, as I expected it would. I did not seek it. I hoped without it I would die. For 9 years I starved. On the 10th year, the limestone from my eyes began to spread, twisting and distorting my face. It traveled to my arms, then my legs and torso. I fractured, my body changing until I was neither human nor animal nor sprite, but a weaving of all three. She gestured at her goat-like body. I became this, hewn of stone. It was excruciating. The Heartsaw Weaver kept coming, her hooves tapping against rocks, her stone wings quivering. She sent me coins from Ashling's coffers to remind me that I was still holy in the eyes of the kingdom. I threw them in the pits of my cave, but ever they mock me, make a false god of me. Nearer and nearer she drew, her steps an ominous clack, clack, like nails in a coffin. I don't know when she decided starvation was a better tool than her hammer and chisel, or when her craft became cruelty. I wonder if the other omens even questioned it. They don't carry the horrible, beautiful burden of memory, of humanness, the way I must. When the first dead diviner was brought to them, did they even pause before drinking her blood, hungry for spring water? Or did they think only of their holiness? That, as gods, a diviner's body, her sacrifice, her tragedy, was owed to them? My heart beat against my breastplate, and the omen came closer, closer. She certainly thinks that way, the Heartsaw Weaver rasped. She believes herself a mother and a god, nurturing Traum with stories of the omens and faith. But is it godly to punish your subjects for questioning you? Is it motherly to demand resolute devotion? She was almost upon me, so near I could see the cracks in her teeth. Moth. She calls herself. An insect made holy for mastering death, but she is not holy. She is the sixth omen, abbess of the Tor. But you know her true name. There is not a man, woman, child, or sprite who does not. It wails on the wind, looms like her eponym cathedral, casting shadows, darkening this land. And then she was right in front of me, her stone eyes locking onto mine. Ashling. I was firm upon my feet, but it felt like a dream, like falling. The end of her lies, her sanctified story draws nigh, omen. Answer me, where is your loomstone? I will tell you. But first, you must begin what you came here to do. Gift me what Ashling never did. She reached for my hand, lifted my chisel. End my battle with time. I have never been able to do it myself. I stared into her stone eyes and waited for a snare, an attack of duplicity or force, like the other omens had tended. None came. The Heartsaw Weaver bore no weapon, but her unrelenting silence as she waited upon my chisel and my answer. I'd lost my voice. All I could manage was a whisper. You want me to kill you?
Yes.
She let out a long breath, stepped over rocks, and came once more to the wall of weavings. Upon a stone table, next to one, beneath the pale cocoons, she laid her body down. I stood over her, Where would you have it? My chisel brushed over her wrists, her throat, then settled over her heart. There is fine, she said. I fixed my chisel in my fist, lifted my hammer. Your loomstone, weaver. Tell me where it is. Strike me first. She shut her eyes and let out a choked laugh. I am ashamed, after all these years spent dreaming of death, that I still fear it. My throat tightened. Be still. I struck. The sound bellowed like thunder through the cavern. Again, the heartsaw weaver said, fissures coursing down her chest. Again, I struck her. The cocoons along the wall trembled. If she felt pain, she bore it. I struck the omen once, twice more, dust filling the air, her goat-like body breaking apart beneath my unrelenting hand. She had no blood within her, composed entirely of limestone, like my wall upon the Tor, like Ashling Cathedral itself. When her limbs were at my feet and her chest fissured beyond saving, the heartsaw weaver let out a gasping moan. That is all. Let me speak. I stayed my hammer. Sweat dripped down the back of my neck into my armor, the joints in my shoulder, my arm aching. The pale cocoons kept trembling. They jerked and swayed until one let out a little white moth. The rest came after. Dozens of moths, struggling within, then breaching their cloistered cocoons and crawling over gossamer, over one, and what remained of the heartsaw weaver, out and into the world. The heartsaw weaver watched them through cracked stone eyes and smiled. Thank you. Her voice was quiet. My loomstone rests where it was made, upon the Tor. I returned it to Ashling when my body twisted beyond all recognition. When I became but one of her many stone creatures, an inhuman gargoyle. She coughed and dust flew, just like that first diviner I'd made a robe for. Footsteps echoed behind me. Sybil? It was Rory's voice, calling me. Sybil! But I was frozen, staring down at the heartsaw weaver, my voice a wretched scrape. But the gargoyles on the Tor, they're sprites. No, they are not. Again, the weaver coughed, more injurious this time. Her body was falling apart. To be a gargoyle, she rasped, is a very strange thing. The ones upon the Tor do not tell the stories of who they are. Indeed, they hardly speak, I think because they do not remember what it is to be human. Or maybe they are too afraid to disobey their master. But not that first one. He was a most peculiar boy. What was his name? The first gargoyle she made. Her breaths were labored. I saw him not 2 days ago, upon my cliff. Came to see him last night, but you frightened me away. What was his name?
Rory kept shouting, his voice desperate. Sybil! Bartholomew! Came the gargoyle's echoing cry.
The heartsaw weaver's breath went out. That's it. The foundling upon the Tor. The first diviner. The newborn moths fluttered, their pale wings beating over stone. The heartsaw weaver watched them with unseeing eyes, her last words quiet as a prayer. Little Bartholomew. Chapter 29. The First Diviner. When Rory and the gargoyle found me,
I was sitting on the stone bench, surrounded by moths, my left hand upon one's body, my right upon the Heartsore Weaver's.
Sybil. Rory was breathless, his face lined with fear.
What?
He took in the room, the omen and the diviner dead within it.
What's happened?
I looked past him, directly into the gargoyle's stone eyes.
The story, I murmured. The one you've tried to tell me. The one with the tragic beginning and the desolate, interminable middle.
He knew. He was the strangest, the wisest creature in all of Traum. So much like a child. Because he was.
The gargoyle folded his hands in front of him, watching the moths.
Would you like to hear it?
Yes. He nodded.
I cannot tell it all myself. I do not remember it all. But I will tell you the story the way she told it to me, in her own words.
He steadied himself, made his voice even, smooth, like the abbess's. It began with a whisper.
You know this story, Bartholomew, though you do not remember it. I'll tell it to you as best I can, and promise to be honest in my tale-bearing. If I'm not, that's hardly my fault. To tell a story is in some part to tell a lie, isn't it? Once you came upon Traum's highest tor, where the wind whispered a minor tune. There, the Gowan flowers were white, and the stones were grey, and both stole the warmth from your bare feet. You were a foundling boy, wandering and starving and alone. You cried out, but there was no one to save you. You lay yourself down in grass, and white moths came to float over you. You shut your eyes and died, Bartholomew. My armor was a ruinous vice. I fought to draw breath. The gargoyle kept going. I found you there, and I, a graver, a kind, quiet carver of stone, brought you to the top of the tor, where a spring of magic water leached. I put that water upon your lifeless lips. You coughed, stirred, and awoke strange, special, and new. I took care of you, Bartholomew. Loved you, like you were my own child. We lived on the tor, needing nothing but spring water to survive. For many years we lived that way. Then, one day, five craftsmen came, all different in mind and manner and skill. One believed in coin, another knowledge. One held fast to strength, another to intuition, and the last to love. Moths fluttered over my hair, stirring it, but I stayed perfectly still. But their finest craft, the gargoyle continued, was arrogance. They could not choose a leader, each believing themselves the superior choice. Tools of their crafts became weapons, and when those were not enough, the craftsmen took to one another with arms and fists and teeth, until they all lay upon the grass, bloodied and silent and still. Rory and I looked at each other, his face the mirror of my own horror. They killed one another, the gargoyle murmured. All five craftsmen, dead. When their bodies were cold, I made a cup of my palms and brought spring water to their mouths, and though they were dead, the craftsmen took in air like it was their first breaths. When they awoke, their eyes were pallid, like limestone. They had no memory of who they were, or how they died, and, oh, how obedient that made them. It was easy to convince them they were divine. Then, with the tools of my craft, I fashioned them each an object from the Tor's magic stone. A coin for the brigand merchant, whom you called artful,
an inkwell for the harried scribe, an oar for the ardent oarsman, a chime for the faithful forester, and a loomstone for the heart-sore weaver. So, you see, Bartholomew, firstly by happenstance, then with great intent, you and I created gods. My hammer and chisel sat in my palms, feeling like 1,000 pounds. The gargoyle went on, his eyes blank, as he recited the abbess's tale. We became Traum's architects, for it was the Tor that we minded, the spring upon it the strangest, the strongest, magic of all. With it, I could bring dead things back to life, but also, I could wield dreams. Did you know that, Bartholomew? That all the dreams you had were by my own design? No, of course you did not know. You were never that clever. You, my little foundling, my perfect diviner, would lie in the spring, and I would press down upon you until you lost consciousness. I could make you dream anything I wished. I showed you frightful hamlets, stone objects, signs. Portents were named, and faith was forged within that spring upon our Tor. A cathedral was built there, and you tiptoed, small as an insect, through the narthex, into the nave, down the aisle. Blood stained your lips, and you fell into the spring that came from that ancient stone upon the chancel. When you looked up at the rose window, the light kissed stained glass. Your craft was obedience. You said the names of gods and how to read their signs. You learned how to dream and how to drown. The gargoyle sighed. But then you stopped obeying me, Bartholomew. You stopped being my perfect diviner. You did not wish to dream or to talk of the omens any longer, for you had helped make them, and therefore could not fully believe in their divinity. You no longer wished to tell a story that was a lie, even when I assured you it was necessary, that the hamlets of Traum had become the Stone Water Kingdom, and a kingdom always needs something to believe in. Constantly I had to child-mind you. When that ceased to work, I remade you. The gargoyle's voice hardened. He shut his eyes, imitating the abbess. Lie in the spring, Bartholomew. What signs do you see, Bartholomew? Don't mix up your words, Bartholomew. Don't cry or be sick, Bartholomew. Ignore all the pain, Bartholomew. Never complain, Bartholomew. Stop humming, Bartholomew. Swallow the blood, Bartholomew. Would that you were a daughter, Bartholomew. Soon I'll replace you, Bartholomew. I'll forget and erase you, Bartholomew. Bartholomew, Bartholomew, Bartholomew. His shoulders shook, and he let out a long, mournful sound. When he opened his eyes, looking me in mine, I knew he was speaking in his own voice now, and not the abbess's. She kept me locked away in the cottage, with no windows. Denied me spring water, thinking I might starve. I do not know how long it took for my body to fracture and change. A long while, I think. I must have gone senseless for the pain. I starved, but I did not die, turning to stone instead. I became a gargoyle, fearsome, a guardian at Ashling's Gate. Suddenly, she was pleased with me again. Suddenly, I was useful once more. After all, swords and armor are nothing to stone. Oh, gargoyle! I ran to him, armor rattling, and threw my arms around his body. He made sad little sounds against my shoulder. She told me to find her more dead foundlings. Girls this time, since I had proved such a disappointment. I searched the gutters of the siege, coarse and fair, the chiming wood, and brought them to the Tor, where she'd fill their mouths with spring water and coax them awake. She tied gossamer over their stone eyes and told them they were strange, special, new. They dreamed in her cathedral as if born of its water, and the story of the omens prevailed. Then, every 10 years, the dreamers would vanish, and new foundlings had to be brought. But the one she liked best, the one she lent her hammer and chisel to, the most obedient, she always kept locked away to make into gargoyles. Rory's face was wan. I suppose I saw it then, the gargoyle said. How she guarded the Tor like a dragon, how she was made as large as a cathedral herself, commanding the omens, the spring, and the foundlings she raised to dream within it. How, like a god, she said she loved us, but hurt us. Tears fell down my cheeks, stirred, then made cold by the fluttering wings of moths. My name was wiped from her stories, and so were the names of all the diviners that came after me. But I tried to hold on. I think I must have spent centuries trying to tell the world who I was in my own peculiar way. I pressed my hands into his stone body. My dream of the moth, that wasn't a sign from gods. You were the one to drown me. It was you, Bartholomew. My tears fell. You, trying to tell me your story. He pulled back to look at me. I'm sorry for all of it, he said, wiping my cheeks. But she gave me a second chance at life, though it was hardly living. My devotion to Aisling was hard to undo. I am sorry I found you, sick in the siege. I am sorry that I brought you back to the cathedral, like the dozens of dead or dying girls I'd brought before. His chin quivered. I'm sorry that, upon the chancel, you died. I'm sorry she remade you with spring water, and that you bore such loyalty to her for it. He wrapped his arms around me. To live again after death is strange magic, and an even stranger fate. Would that things were different, Bartholomew. Would that we had never been reborn. But if we hadn't, well, I have wondered and pondered, and now I am sure, for better, for worse, the rest of the story could not exist without us. Aisling Cathedral returned. Swords and armor are nothing to stone. Chapter 30. The End of the Story. We returned to where Traum's most sanctified story, its most crafted lie, began. The Tor. It had taken all day to get there. I was on horseback, holding tightly to Rory, and for once Fig cantered with urgency, as if she felt our turmoil. Benji rode behind us, without the rest of his knights. What we meant to do was not for them to see. Above, still too injured to ride, Maud flew in the arms of the gargoyle. Our pace was unrelenting, our brows slick with sweat, as we hastened through Traum's hills upon the Holloway Road, hungry to lay all our rage upon the cathedral's door, to collect the last stone object, to kill the final omen, to end the story. We reached the Tor at nightfall. Aisling Cathedral was coated in moonlight. I stared up at its looming edifice, its wall. It was not so long ago the diviners and I had perched, watching the king come, on that very spot. The path felt steeper than it ever had. We reached the cathedral gate and found it shut, locked. Benji held the harried scribe's inkwell and the ardent oarsman's oar, and Maud bore an axe with her uninjured arm. The gargoyle held tight to the faithful forester's stone chime, and Rory, the artful brigand's coin,
which he raised, rough side up, and threw. Aisling's iron gates exploded, announcing us with a thunderous knell. I pushed ahead of the group. Abbess! Gravel flew as I marched into the courtyard. I've come back! The statues in the courtyard watched me, and so did the cathedral's stained glass eyes. The night air was cold, fluttering out of my nostrils on misty tendrils. I raised my hammer. Abbess! My arm, my fury, was exact. I struck the statues, hitting them again and again, unrelenting, until all five were cracked and crumbling. I've come back! Nothing. Then, like the moths I'd watched rise from cocoons, she came. Out from the shadow, the abbess crept, coming to stand before the cathedral's colossal wood doors. Behind her, six gargoyles trailed, chimeras of human and animal features, entirely hewn of stone. The wall of Rory's chest hit my spine, and the gargoyle's, Bartholomew's, stone hand slipped into mine. Even Benji looked fearsome next to Maud, the two of them standing at my wings. We were but five in number, but we felt like an army, come to storm the gates and rip a wicked foe from their towering pedestal. But if our arrival, our appearance, our promised violence touched the abbess, she made no indication of it. She hid behind her shroud, her voice entirely distant. Six. Her chin dipped as she took me in. You've come home. I'd forgotten her effect, how pale her dress and gloves were, how mesmerizing her shroud looked when the wind rippled over it. I came forward like a beast of prey. When I stood before her, our heights were the same. I'd never noticed that. I wanted to see you, I told her, one last time. I struck out, grasped her shroud, tore it off, and gasped. It wasn't just the abbess's eyes, like omens, like diviners, that were hewn of limestone. All of her was stone. She had no hair. Her skin, lips, cheeks, just as pale as her eyes. Only she was not a gargoyle. Her face was still that of a woman. She was beautiful. Mythical, fearsome, entirely inhuman. The abbess never turned her gaze upon Rory, or Maud, or Benji, or even the gargoyle. Her pallid eyes remained ever fixed on me. First the left, then the right, she stripped her gloves, revealing smooth, unblemished stone arms. Were she a carving, a statue, she would be declared perfect. Her craftsman named a master. Her lips spread into a lavish smile. Am I all that you imagined? She reached into her dress. From its neckline, the abbess extracted a stone circle upon a thread. A loom stone. Kill them, she told the gargoyles. She reached out, catching my wrist with bruising strength, then slid a finger into the hole in the loomstone, and the two of us disappeared. I was falling, my body nothing. The abbess and I passed through darkness, into the cathedral, down the nave, over the chancel, where she dropped me. I fell like a stone and collided with water, sucked into the cold womb of the spring. I put out my arms, churning water, trying to reach the surface. A hand found my throat, just above my chainmail, and yanked. I breached the water, gasping. High above me, the night sky touched the cathedral's rose window, painting it blue. But then the abbess loomed over me, blotting out the light. You poor thing. Beyond, echoing down the cathedral's throat,
I could hear the clash of weapons. Rory, Maud, Benji, fighting against the gargoyles in the courtyard. There were gargoyles near the spring, too. 7 of them, closing in from the shadows of the ambulatory. "Did you find what you were looking for?" the abbess murmured, pressing my neck. "Out there, beyond my wall?" "If you mean the truth, Ashling, yes, I did." Her chest heaved, low, contemplative noises sounding behind her lips. "Then you know why you have no memory before this place. No memory of being taken from the gutter, too sick even for the foundling houses in the siege to keep you. No memory of my gargoyle carrying you into my cathedral." She grinned. "No memory of dying." She shoved me back under the water, showing me just how strong she was as she held me down, down. I clawed at her, thrashed, spots bloomed behind my eyes. She yanked me up, air punching its way back into my lungs. "After," she said, like my coughs and splutters were nothing, "I put water to your lips and you awakened, as if reborn. But just as you came, so too must you go. I learned with Bartholomew that no diviner should dream forever. You tend to spoil with time, your loyalty fissuring. You begin to yearn for a life beyond the Tor." She sighed. "That is why, when you, my most perfect diviner, broke my rules and left the Tor for a night of impiety at Coulson Fair, I knew it was time to replace you." She leaned over me, her loomstone dangling from the string around her neck. "I began with 4, slipped the loomstone over my finger, whisked her away. I kissed her brow, held her closely, and broke her neck. That's the beautiful thing about my spring water. It only brings you back once. 4 died, and this time, it stuck." She seemed proud when my eyes grew wide with loathing, a smile upon her pale mouth. She always did love telling a story. "I sent her with a gargoyle who brought her to the Artful Brigand. One by one, I retrieved the diviners with the loomstone, held them in my arms. One by one, I broke their neck. Stripped them of their robes, sent them out into the hamlets that the omens might have their fill. Terribly inconvenient, as I have yet to find new girls. But it had to be done, because you decided to break my rules and lead the diviners off the Tor. So really, my dearest girl, you might say this entire misadventure began," her lips curled, "because of you." I struck her with a closed fist, hard, just beneath the jaw. Her head snapped back, but her grip remained tight over my throat. The gargoyles rushed forward, stone hands catching along my head, my shoulders, my knees, pressing with brutal strength over my armor. I writhed, screamed. But I couldn't get away from them, couldn't get out of the spring. Couldn't move, but to barely hold my mouth above the water's fetid surface. "What about the faithful forester? She's been dead decades." Spring water slipped between my lips, choking me. "Are you such a monster that you would kill one of your own diviners for an omen nigh 30 years gone?" For the first time, emotion touched the abbess's unflinching coolness. Her stone brow twisted, her eyes narrowing. "You did not know she was dead, killed by one of King Castor's knights." I coughed, laughed. "You stand here upon your chancel, upon your Tor, and look down at everyone, looming like a god. But you know nothing of what really goes on in the hamlets, nothing of the real Traum." I choked on water. "It will be your undoing." She squeezed my throat. "Diviners and kings come and go, and so will omens. Traum is but 5 hamlets and me. If my gods are killed, I will make new ones. A diviner's blood is never wasted, so long as someone is fed. Her lips peeled back in a smile. I'm sure their carcasses were a fine feast for sprites. I thrashed in the water. You could have let us go after our service, like you promised. If the omens needed spring water, you could have given them spring water. But blood, my voice ripped up my throat. How could you be so monstrous? To the faithless, a god is a monster. And I am certainly a god. She touched her stone skin. I was born in this very spring, 100 years before Bartholomew came to the Tor. I was a babe, a stillborn. I have never tasted humanity, nor food, only sweet, rotten water. My infant flesh fell away, leaving only stone. She smiled, and there is nothing to stone. She looked down on me, pitiless. But you, flesh and hair and blood, you're young, guileless. You do not understand the weight a god must bear, or that sometimes we must do the wrong thing for the right reason. You do not know what it takes to rule this Tor, and you do not know the responsibility of controlling that which you have created. Starving things make for loyal pets, so long as you feed them just enough. It's how I control my diviners, starving them for love, and it's how I control the omens. They craved spring water, and so I gave it to them, diluted in blood, that they'd always heed me, hungering for more. I'd never heard her laugh before. The sound bubbled out of her, like boiling water. They could have stopped drinking. The Heartsore Weaver did. They would still be eternal, like my gargoyles. But when you tell someone they are a god long enough, they stop believing that they should have to give anything up. All they do is take. Again, she pushed me into the water, held me down, longer this time, yanking me out just before I lost consciousness. Was I not like a mother to you? She whispered, over my soaked face. I couldn't hear the noise in the courtyard anymore. My gasping lungs, my pulse were too loud. Did I not care for you, clothe you, make you wondrous? I would have kept you, Six. You would have made an obedient gargoyle. She ripped my hammer and chisel from my belt. You have been a witness to the wonders of the omens, a pupil to their portents, ever but a visitor to their greatness. When she looked down at me, I could tell she thought it was for the last time. Now, sleep. She kept one hand on my throat and raised the chisel with the other. The gargoyles gripped me harder, holding me still. I fought. My hands breached the water, gauntlets scraping over the abbess's stone face. She let out a hiss, but held fast to my throat. The gargoyles tightened their grips, and when I looked up at the chisel's tip, I was looking up at the cathedral's moonlit windows, too. They in light, I in darkness. All your love and resentment and martyrdom, the abbess said, were for nothing. An inhuman roar shook the cathedral. The chisel stilled, and the abbess's hand disappeared from my throat. She drew back, and so did the gargoyles that held me. I fell, slipping into dark, fetid water. I grasped for the edge of the spring, arms churning, air fleeing my mouth in bubbles. I thought, this time, I finally succumb. This time, the drowning will be complete. Then a man's hand was there, breaching the water, searching, desperate. It clasped the nape of my neck, bringing me out of darkness. I hauled in air, and when spring water fell away from my eyes, all I saw was Rory.
I've got you, Sybil.
He pulled me out of the spring. Beyond, the cathedral had become a battlefield. Maud and Benji were together, Maud with her axe, Benji holding tight to her, flinging the harried scribe's inkwell, disappearing and appearing somewhere else every time a gargoyle drew too close. Maud's face was white, her bandages bloody. Next to her, Benji's left cheek was swollen, his bottom lip split, but his blue eyes remained alight. The abbess stood in the heart of the bedlam. She dropped the hammer and chisel, and I saw then that her perfectly hewn visage was marred. There were teeth marks in her neck, a giant cut of stone ripped out of her. The bat-like gargoyle stood before her, wings spread, baring his teeth, stone shards falling from his mouth. I'd never seen him so monstrous, so befitting of his namesake. A true guardian, not of Aisling, not of the Tor, of me.
No one should live forever in the middle of a story, he murmured. If this is how it should end, Aisling, I am happy to see it done.
Bartholomew, the abbess spat, I should have killed you a century ago. She reached for the loomstone, vanished. When she reappeared, she was high in the cloister, holding to a buttress, looming over us. My cathedral is the keystone to Traum, she called. Take it away, and the kingdom crumbles. I am the architect, the master, the god of this place. Swords and armor are nothing to stone. All around us, her gargoyles closed in. I dropped to my knees, picked up the fallen hammer and chisel. Please, I said to them, go, leave this place and never return. They did not heed me. They were creatures of Aisling, dyed and born of the spring. They kept coming toward me, stone claws reaching for me, for Rory, and I could not save them from what the abbess had done to them. So I swung. My hammer hit stone. There was a great crack, a pouring of limestone dust that stuck to the water on my armor. Rory's coin flew, and the bat-like gargoyle's claws tore, but the others kept coming, and I kept swinging. Until the abbess's gargoyles were nothing but lifeless chunks of stone upon the cathedral floor. She watched from above, looming like a gargoyle herself, untouched by the brutality, the martyrdom of her stone creatures.
Whatever craft is yours, Rory snarled, cruelty or violence, we have beaten you by it. Get down, you fucking coward. Your ending has come.
The King of Traum has taken up the mantle, Maud shouted, holding tight to Benji. Your gargoyles are gone, your omens defeated. Benji's voice, triumphant and a little unbelieving, echoed near and far, distorting through the cathedral. Surrender your cathedral, abbess! You have lost!
Lost?
Once more she vanished, reappearing near the great rose window, casting a shadow over all of us. I will be as the wind, my loomstone keeping me ever out of reach. You may bear my stone objects, but you will not be safe. I will put you down as I did your heretical grandfather, and then I will come back to my Tor, make new diviners, new omens. The story does not change, boy king. The hamlets will always look to their signs, and folk will come to me to divine them. I have my cathedral, my spring, my Tor, the only thing of influence you ever had, Benedict Castor III. She pointed a finger over me. Was her. She appeared right in front of Benji, hit him over the chest with such brutal force, his breastplate dented. He fell, and the abbess reached for her loomstone once more, and screamed. Maud's axe had fallen, and with it, the abbess's stone hand. It fell, hitting the floor with an ungracious bang, as if it weighed 100 pounds. I sprang forward. When our bodies collided, mine and hers, the sound was that of stone crashing into stone, a terrible, vociferous crack. The abbess fell, and I clattered over her, our feet upon the chancel. She reached into her gown, pulled a knife, the same one she carried with her during a divination. It slashed through the air, and when it collided with my breastplate, the peal rivaled the ringing of cathedral bells. I looked down at where she'd struck me, and so did the abbess. My armor was dented, a blooming pain radiating through my chest. She struck me again and screamed, as if she could not fathom why I would not break, like she expected me to be made of nothing but gossamer. "Am I all that you imagined?" I said, looking down at her. "Or am I so much more?" I slammed my fist into her jaw, sending a dozen cracks, like tributaries, into her face. She hit me, too, with such force it felt as if the flesh beneath my armor had burst. Dropping the knife, she struck me with both hands, hitting my breast, my ribs, my arms, kicking at my legs. My skin broke, my armor dented, but I did not diminish. With one vicious tug, I had her careening forward, screaming as she scraped over the chancel, over the edge of the spring, falling into dark, rotten water. I grasped the stone ledge with one hand, and with my other, I pressed. The abbess cried out under the water, clawed and yanked at me, flailed. I kept a grip over her throat and pressed. Bubbles filled the water. I kept her down. I pressed and pressed, drowning her. Then, with all my strength, I pulled her from the water, threw her down upon the chancel. I loomed over her. The gargoyle came to stand with me, then Rory and Maud, and finally Benji. There was no question of which we would take from her, hands or throat. There was no question at all. There was only stone and the tools to make it yield. The abbess was writhing, seething, spitting chunks of limestone upon the chancel. I looked into her eyes, eyes just like mine. Then, with her own tools, with hammer, with chisel, I struck right upon her stone heart. I was not exact as I had been with the heart saw weaver. This was an annihilation, and Aisling would bear the mark of it. My blows were unbridled in their violence, stone flying, hitting my face as they flew by, scoring me with pain. Still, I kept striking her. With hammer, with chisel, I hit her until she was dust, until Traum was free of its false gods, until her last breath came, not loud like the peal of a bell, but frail. Still, I kept striking her. I struck, and I struck, and I struck, until the final omen was dead. Chapter 31. The Last Diviner. The cathedral was a tomb, utterly silent. We stood in a crooked line upon the chancel. From the rubble that had once been the abbess's body, Benji extracted the loomstone. "The final magical object," Maud murmured. Rory didn't look at the loomstone or the abbess. He was only looking at me, wrenching my chin up, searching my eyes. "Are you hurt?" I didn't know. I couldn't feel my body. "The last object isn't the loomstone," I whispered. "It's the spring." My gargoyle, my Bartholomew, came up beside me, nodded at my hammer, my chisel. When I spoke to the king, I hardly recognized my voice. "When will the knights come?" "I don't know. Soon. Do you still want Aisling to shudder?" He studied my face. "I do." I tightened my grip on my hammer, looked to Rory and his coin. "Then help me." Aisling Cathedral was harder to slay than any omen. It did not yield easily to our violence. But Rory had his coin, and I my hammer. Maud had her axe, and the gargoyle his stone claws, and Benji a zeal I had never seen in him before. He was throwing stones, ripping pews from the floor, tossing fallen rubble into the spring, and hitting anything he could with his sword and the inkwell's corrosive ink. When Rory's coin took out the south wall, and I its commanding pillar, we all ran to the other side of the transept as the stones fell. Benji picked up a broken piece of rubble, threw it with impressive strength, and shattered the rose window. Coloured glass rained down, catching moonlight. We all stopped to watch.
Huzzah! The gargoyle cheered.
It's not enough. I could still smell rotting flowers, still taste them on the back of my tongue. We need to bury the spring. The tendons of my arm ached every time I struck a pillar, a wall. I was going for the cloister, the system of pillars along the ambulatory, imagining them veins to a heart that needed severing. I slammed my hammer over and over, cried out in pain. Sybil. I kept hitting. Rory was next to me. Let me help you. I didn't. I bore and bodied all my anguish, beating the pillar again and again. My hammer shattered, breaking down the heart of the head, then the handle. A terrible crack began, spreading up the wall, into the vaulted ceiling. Dust began to rain, and a noise like thunder filled the cathedral. I dropped the chisel.
Time to go, Rory said, catching my arm. We ran.
The tor trembled, and the stones beneath my feet fissured. I caught the gargoyle by his hand, like we were finally escaping that wretched place, and brought us out of the narthex at the heels of Benji and Maud just before the cathedral fell. The world shook. We fled into the courtyard, all the way to the gnarled apple orchard, shards of debris shooting after us. Maud tripped and Benji caught her. Rory held my arm so tightly, the five of us running until we were at the wall, panting and sweating. We watched as Ashling Cathedral fell in on itself, a dragon slain. When the stone stopped rolling and the world stopped shaking, I felt a great stillness in my body. I let go of Rory, let go of the gargoyle, moved to stand alone in the shadow of the wall. Then, a familiar sound came on the wind. Horses, whickering. Were I to climb the wall, I knew what I would see. Purple banners. The knights had caught up to their king. They're here, Maud said through a wince. I can hear them coming. Benji's voice was full of fire. He came to stand by Rory and the gargoyle and drew his sword once more, as if Ashling had bowed to him, prostrate. About fucking time. He swung. His sword lodged in Rory's side, into chainmail, into skin. Rory let out a sharp gasp. Benji caught his wrist, took his coin. He shoved Rory to the ground and kicked him in his wound, then let the coin fly. It hit the gargoyle, shattering his left wing, putting fissures up his arm and into his chest. He stumbled back, blinked his stone eyes. Fell. I screamed. Maud lunged forward, but Benji's sword was already there, pointed in her face. Lower your axe, he told her. Throw it over the wall. Her voice came out soft, but her green eyes were beyond recognition, brimming with pain. Benji, what are you doing? Your axe, Maud. With jerking motions, she did as she was told. I don't remember how I got on the ground, only that I was in the grass next to Rory, next to the gargoyle, crawling over blood and broken stone to be near them. Rory's hand was on his side, the warmth in his skin gone. Oh, gods. I pressed my hand over his wound, blood seeping between my fingers. Rory. Rory. He winced, blinking rapidly. Next to him, the gargoyle lay upon the grass, unmoving. An inhuman sob
tore out of me. I threw myself over him, wrapped my arms around his stone body, and pressed with all my might, as if I could mend the cracks in his chest with the sheer force of my strength. Please, please! Nothing answered, save the wind, as it whispered through gowan flowers. Then,
"I forget, Bartholomew,"
came a slow, craggy voice.
"What were we talking of?"
My tears filled the cracks in his chest. Benji retrieved Rory's coin from the ground. He stood above me, blotting out the moonlight, coin in one hand, sword in the other. He moved its tip from Maud to me. "Come here, Diviner." Rory surged up, landed a brutal punch to Benji's knee. The king faltered back but kept his feet, swiping his sword through the air, slicing Rory over the cheek. Rory fell back onto the grass, shaking, bleeding. "Stop!" I stumbled to my feet, weaponless, as I stood between Rory and the king. Benji swore.
"Guards, Rory!"
He took a few limping steps. "Stay down! I don't want to kill you." He turned to me, flushed. "But that's up to six." My voice trembled. "What do you want?" "The omens are gone. All that power has to go somewhere. I want you to help me carry the burden. I want you to come to Castle Lurik." He said it simply, like he was telling me a story. "I want you to be my queen." Maud let out a low hiss, and Rory... My back was to Rory. But the noise that came out of him was animalistic. Pain and fury. "Benji." I searched the king for his easy, boyish quality. I couldn't find it. "There's nothing left to divine. You know that."
"I do," he said. "But dismantling the cathedral is not like dismantling faith. That takes time. With the spring gone, the hamlets must put their beliefs somewhere. And I've paid for the privilege."
He leaned his head to the side.
"You see, all the wealth your abbess paid her omens, the piles of gold the artful brigand and the ardent oarsman hoarded, the money abandoned in the glen in the Chiming Wood and the Heartsore Weaver's cave, the harried scribe's stores of books in the siege, that wealth, like power, needed to go somewhere. So I put them in the hands of the nobles. Well, the knights, really. Hamelin Fisher, Dedrick Lange, Tory Bassett. You remember their mothers. Noble elders. Very influential. I think even my grandfather would appreciate the enterprising nature of it all. He stopped believing in the omens, just as I did. But time and time again, our Hamlet's creed proves true. The only god of men is coin." "The spring is buried under a mountain of rubble," Maud shouted. There were tears on her cheeks. "There's no way to make Sybil dream. What influence can she have? Stop talking to me like I'm an idiot."
Benji's face went red. He paused, hauled in a reclaiming breath.
"For all her conniving brutality, the abbess did me one favor. She never made it known how the dreams worked. It's why every ma'am and sir and clod of Traum tried to peer beneath Six's shroud. To them, she's magic."
He tapped his fingers on the hilt of his sword, as if waiting for the rest of us to catch up.
"If the noble elders of the hamlet speak highly of me, if Six is mine, folk will come, pay respect, fill my coffers. I'll put a shroud back over her stone eyes and say only she, the last diviner, can read the signs of someone's future."
His cheeks were flushed. With every word, Benedict Castor seemed to convince himself of the truth of his story.
"A new system, a new market, not upon the Tor, but upon the King's door. A new tale of faith now that Ashlings is to the wind." "She's not yours."
Rory struggled to his knees, then his feet. He brought the gargoyle up as well, though it cost him a great deal of blood. He was looking at Benji with so much hate, I felt it in the air.
She'll never be yours.
She will. Or she'll watch the knighthood beat, then stone you and the gargoyle for the desecration of Ashling Cathedral. Rogue mendacious and a mad gargoyle.
Benji looked upon Rory, face twisting, like he was trying not to cry.
I didn't want it to be this way. It didn't matter that you held no political sway. I've always looked up to you. But I could see the signs plain enough. You aren't loyal. Except maybe to her. You encouraged her not to vow to me during her knighting, and I knew once the omens were vanquished that the two of you, lost to love sickness, would no longer be of any use to me.
Breath shuddered out of him.
You're a bad influence, Rory. A bad knight. Sooner or later, it would have come to this.
He turned to Maud. And you, my dearest. This time he did cry, twin tears falling from his eyes.
I have needed you too much, grown accustomed to you being there, telling me what is right. You never saw me as an equal for it. If I am ever to stop being the boy king, I must separate myself from you.
He swallowed.
Besides, I already know what you will say. You are too noble, too good to side with me on this. Maybe that's why my grandfather never got this far. Neither of you understood that for things to go right, you must often do the wrong thing.
Maud's gaze turned from Rory to Benji. Her green eyes held pain, but fury too. For the second time in her life, she stood upon the Tor and had to deny her king.
Then I must withdraw from your knighthood, Benedict Castor. If yours is the crown, I bear no allegiance to it.
Benji brushed away his tears, turned to me, your awful quiet diviner.
Her name is Sybil,
Rory snarled, holding his side, his skin ghostly white. Benji ignored him.
I thought maybe, since you had a hand in destroying Traum's faith, that you might consider helping me rebuild it, that the blood of all those dead diviners might still mean something to you.
He nodded at Rory and the gargoyle and Maud.
I will let them go, but only if you come with me.
Rory surged forward.
Ah, Benji said, leveling the tip of his sword with his throat. Don't be unknightly. Let the lady have her choice.
It was a beggar's bargain, a losing sport, a failed craft. Either way, I was defeated. And Rory was bleeding out. I put a gentle hand on his chest, pressed him back until it was my throat, not his, at the tip of Benji's sword.
Let them go first.
Rory's fingers dug into my arm.
Sybil,
take care of the gargoyle, like you said. I turned, brought his blooded knuckles to my mouth, and kissed them. Take care of yourself, too.
Sybil.
The knighthood was coming. I could hear the sounds of their horses over the gravel in the courtyard, hear their gasps as they took in the desecrated remains of Ashling. Benji tossed the artful brigand's coin. There was a rumbling explosion, rock and dust in the air. When it cleared, there was a hole in Ashling's wall.
Your exit.
Benji retrieved the coin from the grass.
Over here!
He called to the knighthood, turning once more to Rory and Maud. When he looked upon them, his gaze was so forlorn, I was sure he would change his mind. That the easy, boyish Benji would appear and apologize and make everything right. I was wrong. The king's blue eyes grew clouded, cold.
This is the only gift you get. If you try to retrieve her, if I see you again in any capacity.
His gaze fell to the wound in Rory's blooded side, then the gargoyle's shattered wing and its answering fissures. And that certainly is an if. I will proffer no pity.
You'll be executed.
He nodded to the hole in the wall.
Now go.
Rory was still saying my name, leaving a trail of blood in the grass when Maud began to drag him. Where are we going? The gargoyle asked sweetly, dropping pieces of stone from his wing as he followed Maud. Rory caught himself on the wall. I felt his gaze on my face, in the air, in the broken pieces of stone around us. He didn't say it, but I knew. He'd do anything I asked of him. So I looked at him, in his fathomless eyes, watched as they lost their light, told him, in a voice cold as stone, "Go." "Where are we going?" the gargoyle asked again. He looked back at me. "We can't go without Bartholomew." I turned away, tears falling down my face. "Wait, wait!" The gargoyle began to sob, more pieces of stone falling from his body. "I'm her squire. We cannot be apart." He had to be hauled away by Maud, who was already doing the same to Rory. I heard his wailing sobs on the other side of the wall. "Bartholomew!" And then they were like all the other things I dared to love. Gone. The knighthood came into the courtyard, and I was just as I'd been all those weeks ago, barefoot in the apple orchard, martyring myself. "Have a little faith, Six," Benji said, his voice stilted. "Can't you see I've set you free?" I looked over my shoulder, the ghost of Aisling still on me, cold, beautiful, and disapproving. "Free, boy king. You don't need the signs anymore. You've seen this world for what it is, a tale of lurid contradictions, a true story, and also a lie. You've known coin, knowledge, strength, intuition, love, life and death, and beaten them at their craft. You've known everything, Diviner, and to be all-knowing." The King of Traum smiled at me, his future queen. "What is a god, if not that?"
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Knight and the Moth, The Stonewater Kingdom, Book 1. Written by Rachel Gillick. Read by Samantha Heidson. Produced by Melanie Schmidt. Post-production by Ji-Yun Lee. Quality control by Molly Thompson. The Knight and the Moth is also available in print and as an ebook from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2025 by Rachel Gillick. Audio production copyright 2025, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.